So, 410 is the fall of Rome, right? Everything changes. The Germanic tribes from the north finally penetrated the south, and the city of Rome falls. From that point forward, you have to think of the Roman world as two separate kingdoms, almost like you do Israel back during the Old Testament. After Solomon, Israel divided into northern kingdom and southern kingdom, and at this point, Rome and the Roman world divides into Western Empire and Eastern Empire. Eastern Empire will be centralized in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. That's where the emperor will reside, and they will pretty much control what was the eastern part of the Roman Empire. From 410 until 1000, you know, for a period of 600 more years, the Eastern Empire will be relatively consistent and relatively stable, politically speaking, not necessarily religiously speaking, but politically speaking. I mentioned this in worship on Sunday in one of the services. I may not have mentioned it in both, but I talked about how the game of theological debate is usually born out of political stability. In our country today, we've had relative political stability and freedom as worshipers for a long time. And so as such, we go to school, we study, we write theology, we debate, we dialogue. In a world where there's not much political stability and you are fighting for your very lives, you could be put to death tomorrow because of your faith, you're simply trying to survive. A lot of those, you know, debating about theology is bypassed for more pressing matters, survival. And so what happens is, at this point in 410, the Eastern Empire becomes the center of theology for the Christian world, and a lot of its history revolves around these ecumenical councils where they're debating and deciding whether Jesus is two natures or one nature, whether he had two wills, a divine will and a human will, or one will, whether we should use icons and images in our worship or whether we shouldn't. You know, these kinds of things that even today sometimes we think, that doesn't seem like that important of a thing. It's what they did. And your centers of Christianity, Alexandria in Egypt, Antioch in Syria, Constantinople in Asia Minor, Damascus, even to some degree Carthage in North Africa. These were places where the bishops of those areas had influence, and debate ranged, and for 600 years this was a lot of what took place. In the western part of the empire, all of a sudden you went from being unified in one empire to having all these different Germanic tribes, and some were occupying Spain, and a different one was occupying Gaul or France, and Angles and Saxons were moving into Britain, and you had Vandals moving into North Africa where Carthage was. You had any number of different occupiers of Italy. Italy, where Rome was the most prestigious of all, and so there was Lombards, there were Franks, there were Visigoths, there were all kinds of different tribes that were trying to occupy Italy. And so in that time period, the history is much more political. It's the church in Rome and the bishop of Rome still trying to guard Rome and guard its influence and the political moves that it would make. They'd be occupied by one people, or another people was coming to capture Rome, and they would be working a political deal with another tribe for protection. They would be sending missionaries to different parts of the Western Empire. The history is much more chaotic because the political world was a lot more chaotic. And so the church, when you think about Western Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, a lot of those major shifts began to take place in the Middle Ages during this time period. The ultimate schism won't take place until the 11th century, 1050s. whenever West and East officially break. But we cover this time period from the fall of Rome to Charlemagne in 800, who will kind of reestablish the Western Empire. 410 to 800 is 400 years in which the western part of the Roman Empire was a complete mess. And the church, fighting to stay alive, was not as concerned with all of the theological points the East was concerned about. They were concerned about evangelism, growing the church, survival, defending our cities, making sure we're not executed, things like that. So two totally different histories. And trying to read them, even in the textbook, is a little bit like trying to read 1 Kings or 2 Kings or Chronicles when it's telling you a little bit of history in the north and then it jumps and tells you some history in the south and then it jumps back to the north and then it jumps back to the south and you kind of catch yourself, all of it kind of runs together and it's hard to distinguish between the two empires. So what we have in the notes, and hopefully there'll be more coming momentarily, are three major lectures. One of them is the situation in the West, which is a lot of politics, both towards the end of that one and the second set of notes. In the West, the two big institutions that were already in place but really expanded and served to unify the Christian community, the Christian church, as they were under occupation by different Germanic peoples, two institutions that were very significant. You guys know what they are? Can you guess? Anybody? Big, big ones. One was the papacy, the Bishop of Rome, who would become the bishop of all bishops. And the other one was monasticism. And we've already seen monastic life in the East, but in the East, people would go off and live in the desert because they were just trying to get away from everybody. It was isolationist. In the West, monasticism would look very, very different. And so that's the second set of notes. And then the last set of notes is a list of all of the ecumenical councils. We've already looked at the Council of Nicaea, which is 325. I don't know if Garrett covered the first Council of Constantinople in 381. He did. And so after that, there are five more that really define the history of the church in the eastern part of the empire during the Middle Ages. We have more councils at Constantinople. We have a council at Chalcedon that was very important. And there'll be a second Nicene council in the 8th century. And so that is, for me, it's a little bit of oversimplification. But the hit during the Middle Ages, if we go 400 roughly to 1,000, 400 to 800, the history of Christianity in the West is marked by politics and popes and monasteries. The history in the East is marked by all of those same things. It's political, but it's ecumenical councils. It's bishops of different areas jockeying for position and trying to win over one another in these ecumenical councils. And so it's theology and survival is the oversimplified differentiation. So a lot of the first two sets of the first two bullet points here on this first page point to this, the theological political situation in the East. You see under B, the Western political situation, you have Attila the Hun. They were trying to press on Rome. And one of the early popes, who is the modern era considered to be the first pope, Pope Leo, was able to persuade Attila not to invade and sack Rome. That was one of his marks of greatness. The Vandals in the early 5th century move into North Africa. In 455, they would sack Rome. The Visigoths ended up settling into Spain. Ostrogoths in Italy. The Lombards, the Franks, predominantly in Gaul or France. Now, there was a point that we mentioned last week or week before. The big controversy around the Council of Nicaea was about Arianism. And from 325 to 410, you had people almost grouped. I mean, it was like the first two denominations within Christianity. You were either Arian, which was spoken of like a heresy, or you were orthodox. And orthodox meant that the decisions of the Council of Nicaea, that Jesus was fully God and fully human, if you believed that, you were considered orthodox. If you believed that Jesus was, I always get it mixed up on Arian. I think that he was fully human but not really fully God, then you were an Arian. This idea, by the way, this is the teaching of the Islamic faith that's going to pop up during this Middle Age period. Jesus was a great prophet. You think of Arianism, it's what's represented by Jehovah's Witnesses today. They acknowledge Jesus' importance and his being sent from God, but they would not agree that he is fully divine. And so we get 1,700 years removed from the Council of Nicaea and the debate over Jesus' divinity, and we still have people today that will say Jesus was a great teacher, a compassionate leader, but was not God. And so we still have, you know, we're still fighting the same issues. You know, when the Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door and knock and want to tell you about how they're Christians and how they believe in Jesus, they do. They just believe different things about Jesus than we do. And so the importance there is, while the Orthodox belief had popularity in a number of places, the kings, you'll remember, some of the emperors of Rome favored Arianism and had the resources and the power to send Christian missionaries who happened to be of Arian persuasion north to the Germanic tribes. And from all throughout the 4th century, they were very successful in converting Goths and Vandals to Christianity, but an Arian version of Christianity. And so whenever in 410, whenever all these Germanic peoples begin flooding into the western part of the Roman Empire, what did they bring with them? All of a sudden, this whole Arian controversy was brought back to the forefront, and the Orthodox Church was fighting a battle that they'd thought 100 years before they had already won. And so particularly in North Africa, Carthage, Mauritania, where the Visigoths ended up, Arianism really kind of became prominent again. In Spain, it became prominent again. In France, what was France then, in Italy, the Orthodox position, the people kind of gradually won out and converted those Germanic tribes to Orthodox Nicene belief in Jesus. And so Italy is predominantly Roman Catholic. France is very Catholic. Germany is very Catholic. North Africa, there's hardly any Christian presence there at all. And that's going to be compounded by the fact that from 400 to 700, the Christian church in that area couldn't decide if it was Arian, if it was Nicene, if it followed Rome, if it followed Constantinople. There was all these, it was just this tumultuous, we couldn't agree. And so whenever the Islamic peoples come into North Africa, it made it very, very easy for most people in modern-day Algeria, Morocco, that area, to say, man, the Christians for 300 years haven't been able to figure out who we should follow and who's in charge and what we believe. And it's just been, you know, they take our money, it's taxes and all this. And the Islamic people coming into those areas were almost seen as a reprieve for them. It made it very easy. So North Africa, the Christian presence in those countries just practically disappeared. All these Germanic peoples, predominantly Arian, and so you see that on point C, theology, number one, Arianism. Number two, some invading leaders were converted to Catholicism. The Merovingian king Clovis, he was the second Merovingian king, which were the Franks ruling in France. That's why if you watch The Matrix, the Merovingian is very French, I think. He was, before there was a France, he was a Frankish leader and established a dynasty that would run all the way to, I think, to Charlemagne, perhaps. The Carolingian dynasty will replace the Merovingian dynasty at some point. The Burgundian king was converted. Visigoth king in 586, during that time period, was converted. And so Christianity was trying to decide if the Aryan Germanic peoples would win out or if the Orthodox church in those countries would win out. And more often than not, the Orthodox belief in those countries had enough roots that they, just out of sheer stubbornness and persistence, ended up winning the day and converting some of these Germanic kings to Orthodox Christianity. And in the places where they did, they're countries that have a long history of Christianity. Spain, Germany, England, Italy, France. And places where they didn't, it's because the Orthodox Church didn't win the day, and it led to a great deal of confusion within Christianity. Roman numeral 2, the rise of the papacy, we're not going to talk about that too much, but if that's something you're interested in, there's reference in the book about it, and you can kind of flip through those notes. I mentioned Leo the First, who's generally regarded as the first pope of the modern era. Of course, if you know good Catholic, what's the right word I should use? I was going to say propaganda, and that's not the right word to use. I've been watching too many political debates and too many news shows. The Catholic story, they like to trace the papacy all the way back to Peter. Peter came to Rome. He was the leader. He was the first bishop of Rome. And then we'll go, our second bishop of Rome is Clement. But even there, you have some stories that say Clement was second. You have other stories that say Clement was third. They kind of trace it up. But for historical purposes, the first bishop of Rome who functioned as the lead bishop for all of the Western Empire, Leo the First, would be your guy. And the next page, number 4, you see him mentioned. 440 to 461 was not his lifespan. He would have only been 21 then. That was the period of his bishopric, would be, I think, the correct term. You see, he saved Rome from being sacked once by Attila and the Huns, again by the Vandals. Repeatedly was confirmed by the emperor in his ecclesiastical advices to other churches, acted as an arbitrator in several disputes. This began, at this point, the bishop of Rome was just another bishop. The same way you'd have a bishop in Damascus and a bishop in Constantinople and a bishop in Augustine was bishop. Every city had a bishop. He was the lead Christian for all of the different Christian communities in the city. He was a bishop of Rome, but because Rome was Rome, people looked to there for help. They looked there for advice. They looked there for arbitration, and thus began the gradual move towards the bishop of Rome gaining a lot more influence and power than any of the other bishops. So Leo the First is an important guy to know. Anybody else over here need notes? Thank you, Kyle. Everybody tell Kyle thanks. Another very important guy, Gregory the Great, at the bottom of that page, letter F, was not the next bishop of Rome or the next pope. Pope, by the way, means father, right? Which abbot means father, just different language bases. Abbots would become the rulers of monasteries. The pope would be the ruler of the bishopric of Rome. It's just father, 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 different fathers. Rabbi. Rabbi means teacher, not father. But Gregory the Great, 590 to 604, was important for a lot of reasons. He would be the next most influential during this time period. And you see there under small letter C, he really began consolidating the power within the bishopric of Rome. Really began kind of centralizing and elevating that position. Developed a uniform liturgy, number 2, which is the Gregorian chant. He's the guy that the chant is named after, if you're familiar with that. Began enforcing celibacy on all clergy. That was not original to the Catholic Church or the Roman Church. He sent missionaries to Northern Europe, for example, Augustine to Britain. And there's a long story there. The Christian church had spread to the British Isles, not the British Isles, but you know what I mean, Britain, the United Kingdom, and the Roman Catholics kind of came in, and Celtic Christianity was ruled out, and commitment to the Roman Catholic Christianity was mandated, and if you didn't make the switch, then there was a whole brand new set of persecutions within the United Kingdom based on whether you would follow the Roman Catholic version of Christianity or you follow your own Celtic version of Christianity. So this was one of the first times we actually had the church exercising persecutions against other people within the church. Now, we're used to having persecutions when it's outsiders, but now all of a sudden we're executing one another because we don't agree on theological matters or political matters or who's the boss. But Gregory sent Augustine to Britain. One of his big contributions is Saint Augustine, not Augustine the missionary, but Saint Augustine that we talked about last week. Augustine was a thinker. He was an investigator. He acknowledged mystery and the character of God. Augustine would probably always be an influential figure to the Christian church regardless. But Pope Gregory loved the writings of Augustine. He wrote about the writings of Augustine. He championed Augustine. He elevated Augustine almost to biblical canonical status. And he would take some things that Augustine would write about just in theory, you know, these are some ideas, these are things I'm thinking about, these are questions that I have. And Gregory would take Augustine's hypotheticals and turn them into Catholic definitives. Two very significant ones on the next page. And I should have brought my book because it has the quote from Augustine. He's talking about the possibility that maybe for those who die and are not in a right relationship with God, that there might be an opportunity or a place where they can be purified of their sins and still gain heaven. Augustine was not giving biblical basis for that. He was not claiming that as a definitive idea. He's just saying, you know, as I think about, you know, maybe as some of you have thought about wrestling with, you know, people that die but don't have a chance to hear the gospel and what happens. Do you have the quote there? Thank you, Mark. Is it on this page? Gregory. Yeah, papacy. Serious. Gregory. Yeah, you did. There, it's probably. But anyways, what Augustine talked about is a hypothetical, you know, just saying maybe, you know, I wonder if there's a possibility that there might still be a chance for people who die and they're not in a completely right relationship with God. Pope Gregory comes in and reads that in Augustine and makes it definitive doctrine. There is a place, and we'll call it purgatory. And thenceforth from Gregory on, the Catholic Church has operated on the idea that what Augustine first stated as a possibility is indeed reality. Very significant movement. You see the influence that's had on the Catholic Church and on all of Christianity, and that's, you know, around 600. That doesn't go back to the beginning of the Catholic Church, and it really doesn't go back to the Bible. Now, they would work at connecting it to the Bible roundabout now that we've already bought into it, but that was a definite issue. The second one is listed there as on D, that the Mass is a perpetual sacrifice of Christ. Every time you come to Mass and you take the Lord's Supper, it's an ongoing sacrifice of Christ, and you are taking the body and the blood of Jesus into your body. They transform into the body and blood of Christ, and that remains the predominant view of communion in the Roman Catholic Church today. And so Augustine had talked about that, had written about that, but not in any definitive terms. But Gregory, because he loved Augustine so much and he was so influenced by his writings, came in and said, this is the way it is. So Augustine is a great writer, a great Christian leader. He was really boosted up by Pope Gregory the Great. So early popes, the papal history really gets colorful after Charlemagne in 800 reestablishes a political unity in that part of the world. I don't think there's a whole lot of other notes in here about the popes. There may be some others. During this time period of the Middle Ages, one of the other really interesting dynamics was one time in particular, the Lombard peoples were marching on Rome, and the Pope at the time sought help from the Franks and paid a lot of money to the Franks, and the Franks defended them, and this developed a long-standing relationship of support between the Franks and the papacy. And so, you know, I don't know if you pay a whole lot of attention to it. Italy is, you know, is Vatican City is located in Italy. Italy's kind of the heart of the Roman Catholic world. But France is not, it's almost like a 1B. I mean, you've got major cathedrals and rich history with the Roman Catholic Church in France. And some of that relationship was settled even before France was France. The tribes that were operating there developed this symbiotic relationship with the Roman papacy and were, you know, you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours kind of relationship for a long period of time. But that was one of the developments that was influential with the popes during the Middle Ages. So these notes go into British Christianity, which the textbook doesn't have a whole lot to say about. If you look down at letter C, he gives some characteristics of British or Celtic Christianity. Number two, concentrated on the study of Scripture. Hey, we like that, right? Number three, missionary zeal, mainly from the Irish and from the Scots, desire to spread their faith. Five, humility and simplicity in lifestyle, but not of the monastic variety, just, you know, living simple lives and caring for one another. The next page, you see Gregory the Great sends Augustine, his missionary, to convert the Saxon people. Number three, when British Christians resisted, that's Roman Catholic Church authority and Saxon rule, thousands were massacred. Prior to that, really the big spread of Christianity in that part of the world was the 5th century, around 432 onward. You see number one, Patrick, who is a native of Britain, evangelized Ireland, and that Patrick is the one you guys know as St. Patrick, right? Oddly enough, he was not Catholic. He was not loyal to the Bishop of Rome. He was just a Christian missionary, you know, in Ireland, and the Irish were evangelized, and then the Irish began spreading the gospel to the Scots. I've always found it interesting that St. Patrick was Irish and evangelized in a part of the world where they developed a Christianity that looked one way and then were persecuted and executed and forced into following Christianity the Roman way. And Patrick was made a saint later on, even though his version of Christianity was probably a little bit different than that advocated by the church in Rome. I had highlighted F3, the Synod of Whitby, just because that was in the textbook. That was really 664 was when the areas of England kind of committed to the Roman Catholic Church. And the statement, there was another quote in the book about about the emperor who came and said he was trying to decide between the Roman path or between the Celtic path, and he said, I've always heard that St. Peter holds the keys to heaven. Is it true that Peter goes all the way back in the Roman church? And of course they said yes, and so he said, well, then I'm going to side with them lest I get to the gates of heaven and Peter locks me out. And so that began the greater significance or greater influence of Roman Catholicism in England. But, you know, the history of England would show that while there's heavy predominance of Catholicism in Spain and France and Germany, England really, I mean, today is not known as a center of Catholicism. It's really known much more as a center of Anglicanism, the Church of England. And so their roots in not being affiliated with Catholicism kind of came in and then went back out much more easily than it would in other places, like the Franks, the Frankish people, that had such a, you know, a connected relationship to the papacy in Rome. All of that, I mean, that's history of the West, and obviously that's a very cursory view. In 800, Charlemagne is going to become kind of the new emperor of the West, and all of these different sporadic people groups ruling in different areas is going to solidify again, and with Charlemagne becoming emperor, so to speak, or king, the papacy is really going to get, you know, intertwined with the government, and that's going to allow for a lot of, you know, misuse of the church and, you know, corruption within the papacy. But really, up until this point, the papacy, the bishops of Rome were really good religious leaders. I mean, they may have been short-sighted in some things that we can see 1,000 years later, but they were good leaders for Rome in very difficult days. They protected the city. They did their best to protect Italy. They protected the church where they could. They had a continuous conversation with the Bishop of Constantinople and the eastern part of the empire. They had influence on one another. And so it was... You know, not if you think negatively of the papacy based on some really corrupt figures that are going to come in the medieval period, the Middle Ages it really wasn't that bad. It kept the Western Empire churches unified. The other thing that served that same purpose was the monastical system. But before we get to that. This next lecture, you have page 87 at the top, talks about the church, how the church had spread beyond the boundaries of the Roman Empire. We talk most of the history of Christianity is within the Roman Empire, but the church had spread to all of these other places, to Persia, Armenia in the east, to Georgia in the east. It had spread to Ethiopia through Egypt in the south. It had spread to Ireland, we already talked about, in the west. It spread to the Germanic tribes in the north. So while Rome was really worried on empire building, the Christian church still had a missionary heart. Long after the first generation of Christians, you still had the Christian church at the edges of the empire saying, how do we take the gospel even further out? And the Christian church, you know, there's a document in the book that I noticed that was a text from China. I mean, there was a Christian presence in China in the 600s. So the Christian church continued to spread. Part of the reason why its presence is not as predominant in some of those areas now as you might think it would be is in large part because of the rise of Islam, and that is what this set of notes represents. You see Roman numeral 2 at the bottom of that page introduces the subject of the rise of Islam. A lot of the history of Muhammad and his... early life, his rise to influence and power are listed there. You know, the interesting thing about, there was a Christian presence in Arabia, by the way, whenever Muhammad came to power. The problem was, it was a very unorthodox, very confused version of Christianity in Arabia. And so what Muhammad was responding to was Christianity as he saw it, and Christianity there was, they couldn't agree on whether they were Arians or Nicene Orthodox or whether, kind of the same in the north of Africa, whether they followed the Bishop of Constantinople or the Bishop of Rome. They couldn't decide whether they were pacifists or whether they would take up arms and fight. There was just no unified presence. Arabia was very much the frontier for the Christian church in that part of the world. But Muhammad had this response to Christianity, not of St. Patrick in Ireland, not of, you know, Benedict and the monks that were communally living and serving people around them. His response to Christianity was this scattered, unorthodox, confused version that was existing in Arabia at the time. I think of his There are a lot of parallels with Muhammad in Arabia in the 600s and Joseph Smith in Pennsylvania in colonial days in the U.S. They were operating in a place where Christianity was not healthy and was not a good picture of the church. And so they built opinions about the whole faith based on what they were exposed to, and then had prophetic visions and dreams about how the true faith of God was not this, and so I need to be a champion of it moving in another direction. Muhammad claimed that what he was doing was perpetuating the truths of the one God that was represented in the Bible of the Hebrews and in the person of Jesus, and he was receiving visions. He believed and claimed that it was the same God, but that what he saw living around him in Arabia was not exemplified by the pillars of generosity and prayer and commitment to one God. There are very good chances. Muhammad's period of influence, by the way, was only about a decade, about 10 years. And then the caliphs that followed him kind of took over political leadership, and that's when Islam became much more of a militarized movement, expanding and taking over other countries. Not so sure that Islam turned out to be exactly what Muhammad had in mind, but his period of leadership and influence didn't last long enough to do very much other than just kind of pick up and throw things into order and give other people an opportunity to set this thing moving in another direction. Very much the same with the figure that we refer to as Buddha. We travel to Thailand. It's interesting to me that Buddha was an Indian who left India because he was trying to flee Hinduism. He became disillusioned with Hinduism. And then after he died, in most of those Southeastern Asian countries where Buddhism is still present, it looks very, very Hindu. Because after he died, Hindu religious figures from India kind of moved back into those countries where Buddha's influence had propagated and kind of began gradually pulling people back in, even under the teachings of Buddha, pulling people back into Hindu-type imagery and icon and story. Same deal with, so Buddhism may not have taken the same direction that Buddha himself would have thought. Possibly the same with Muhammad. I'm not an expert in Islamic thinking or Quranic texts, but his story is very interesting. You see some of the pillars there. If you go to page 91, you see where Muhammad has died and Islam begins to spread. And within about 20 years of them moving, they had taken over Alexandria, they had taken Jerusalem, they had taken Damascus, they had taken Carthage. Places that were significant centers of Christianity fell to the Islamic armies. And in many of those places, particularly North Africa, Christianity just kind of disappeared. It ceased to exist. In some of those other places, because of Jerusalem, they crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and moved into Spain and took much of Spain before finally they were met and headed back off. And it was a long story about Spain kind of coming back around. But when we get into the next millennium, the second millennium of church history, we get to the Crusades. A lot of that is going to be over places like Jerusalem and Damascus and Antioch and Alexandria, centers of Christianity that have been overrun, and the Christian church kind of coming back around and saying, especially Jerusalem, Bethlehem, the places of these holy locations, we need to go back and take. And as you know, some of those fights are still going on CNN tonight when you get home. Even today, still is part of our story. So, monasticism. Man, we're going to run out of time. Monasticism arose in the East. We talked about how it was very isolationist, hermetic. Go out and live by yourself. Number four there, the main tenets of cenobitic monasticism: obedience, chastity, poverty. But in the West, it was different. The goal was not to go out and be by yourself, and the goal was not to beat your body into submission only for the purpose of beating your body into submission. It was more practical. You see there, not severely ascetic, developed a vision for missions. When we think of the commune or the convent where monks or nuns would live, they kind of operate and live and serve the people, and that really is a Western version of monasticism, not isolationist. It emphasized community, living together, was not in constant tension with the church. If you remember, in the East, people moved out into the desert because they were uncomfortable with Constantine wedding the government with the church. They were uncomfortable with that idea. And so you had some people that bought in and championed this, the end of persecution. You had some people who said, that's not the real church. We're going to be the real church, and did church in a different way. And then you had those who said, we're just going to the desert. We're just going to pack up and leave. Jesus is coming again soon. I'm reminded the very first people that thought Jesus was coming back in their lifetime were the very first followers of Jesus. And we're still sitting around waiting. But they were not in constant tension with the church. These Western monasteries worked with the church. Benedict, 480 to 542, is the father of Western monasticism, and that's why we refer to them often as Benedictine monks or Benedictine monastery. His monastery was at Monte Cassino, and I meant to look that up. I'm not entirely sure where Monte Cassino is. The monastery was burned by the Lombards, but I'm not entirely sure where that is. Do you know? Tuscany? It's in Italy. Okay. You see, his two primary characteristics were permanence. In other words, you can't just be jumping around and moving. You go to a monastery, you commit to be there for life. And obedience. Obedience to the scriptures and obedience to the chain of command within the monastery. Benedict's big contribution was a writing called the Benedictine Rule that talked about life in the monastery. Prayer was very important. They had a system of 7 daily prayers that really is not a whole lot different than what the Islamic practitioners practice with their daily prayers. They did it in the Benedictine monasteries as well. Well-developed hierarchy. The big spread happened when, you see, under C, the Lombards sacked Monte Cassino in 589. All these monks fled to Rome. Benedict had already died, but they carried to Rome his writing, the Benedictine Rule, and the church in Rome got a hold of it and valued it, and thus the Western monastic idea of Benedict went from being just one place at Monte Cassino. Once it hit Rome, that's kind of like, something, one part of your body, once it hits your heart, it goes everywhere. And Rome was the heart of the empire, and once Benedict's rule made it to Rome, it became the rule for Western monasteries all over the Western part of the Roman Empire. You see, reasons for the attraction of communal monasticism, achievements of monasticism, where it was helpful, became centers of Christian culture, conservatories of learning, engaged in missionary work, produced writers, philosophers, led in the Crusades and the Inquisition, if you think that's a benefit. You see, problems on the next page. It discredited regular Christian life. Became narrow, bigoted, intolerant. Anytime something within Christian church you find, anytime it becomes popular or powerful, what is soon on its heels? Corruption. It almost never fails. And drained Europe of productive population, undercut married life, a variety of other things. So became an abused tool of the papacy, definitely. But the papacy and monasticism were the two big responses in the West. And in an environment of political chaos, these two things really serve to kind of keep the Western church unified, keep it together, keep it moving forward and advancing. And so despite their flaws, they both, at least during the Middle Ages, this 400 to 800 period, really served a positive purpose and positive role in the church. Comments or questions? That's a whole lot. I told you, man, we were covering a lot and not a lot of time to do it. Yeah, Walt. When could priests absolve people from sin? I think so. Actually, you know what? I think that it was after that, because the importance of this verbal confession and priests hearing you and absolving you really came out of Ireland later on. Do any of you guys remember reading that? It was in the book. He talked about that the development of confession and absolution didn't originate in Rome, it originated in Ireland. But somebody, and it might have been Gregory, learned of it. In fact, it might have been Gregory, Walt, learned of it and then kind of conscripted it into general practice within the Roman church. Yes? The Bible is not widely available, yeah, and will not be until the inventing of the invention of the printing press, yeah. And so this was another role that the monasteries did, was they would copy scriptures. I mean, they'd spend hours and hours and hours a day copying scriptures, and so pretty much any church had access to the scriptures, but just your common attendees, common Christians, did not. And that's part of the importance of worship, was going and listening to the scriptures being read. Importance was not as much on sermons and exposition as it was just reading, because people couldn't read the Bible. And so it's widely available to the church. It's being translated into lots of different languages. A lot of key figures here are translating the Bible into Syriac. They're translating it into Aramaic. They're translating into Slavic for the Eastern European peoples, translating into Germanic. It's beginning to be translated in lots of different languages, which is a good thing, but still only available to priests, bishops, clergy at the church level usually. Good question. Yes?
So you don't hear about the magic news, but we talk about all these councils. Are the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church still having councils, or do they stop having councils?
To the best of my knowledge, the question is, are the Orthodox churches and Roman Catholic churches still having councils? Not at that kind of, you know, they called those the big ecumenical councils. In fact, sometimes, you know, the Council of Nicaea is called the first great ecumenical council. Constantinople 381 is the second ecumenical council. They were called the ecumenical councils because, in general, everybody was invited to the table and everybody had input in what was going on. And today, you'll see the Roman Catholic Church getting together and issuing their, you know, their statements, papal decrees, things like that. The Orthodox churches are doing that, but they're pretty much not working together. And so what you see as an ecumenical council, I would think, based on those terms, would have to involve all of those and representatives from Protestant churches as well for it to be truly ecumenical. And yeah, that's, now I don't know that we'll ever see that again until glory, but unless somebody knows differently, I've not been aware of anything like that. Charles, you know of any? That's where we need Garrett here to kind of comment on. Praying to the saints. So that's going to come in actually the last of these councils, the Second Council of Nicaea. The big issue was images and icons and what images and icons represented. And a lot of language in which the council approved the placement of icons and said that they can be revered but not worshipped. And I think that's terminology that in Orthodox and Catholic churches, even today, you'd still hear when they talk about Mary, we pray to Mary, but they would say, we don't worship Mary, we revere her. And that goes all the way back to 787, Second Council of Nicaea. Yeah. But there was a lot of debate about whether we can have images or not, and the East and West didn't agree on necessarily how that should operate. The last set of notes here are all of the notes on these major ecumenical councils. You see them outlined or listed there at the beginning, Roman numeral 1, Nicaea, the first Nicaea 325, the big issue was Arianism. Constantinople 381 was still Arianism. And all of these in the middle, all the big theological debates were about Jesus. I mean, how do we, and ultimately, how do we make sense of the fact that he was fully God and fully human? How can that be? How they don't go together. The example, I think, that Gonzalez used in the book, he said, was if somebody told you to make hot ice cream, you might could put ice cream on a hot plate, you might could put it on a warm piece of pie, But if you're trying to make hot ice cream, the two just don't go together. And so there was all these debates about what are the natures. Is it one nature, divine and human? Two natures or one nature? Is it two wills? Does he have a divine will and a human will? Or is it one will? Is he the same substance as God? Is he a similar substance as God? Is he a different substance from God? A lot of these things. And there's a very interesting guy, John of Damascus, comes in late during this period. And John of Damascus was a Christian figure in an Islamic-run part of he's in Damascus after the Islamic peoples had come in and conquered it. And his writings were very distinct, very revolutionary, in light of all of the arguing and yelling the church had done for so many centuries. But he was one of the first people to say, you know what, we need to differentiate between that which we can know and that which is part of the mystery of God. You know, the church forever said, this thing about Jesus being fully God and fully divine, we've got questions, we've got to come up with answers. If you don't agree with me, you're a heretic. And a lot of the history in the Eastern Empire, you can read through some of this, that was what it was about. The Council of Ephesus, 431, you see there the issue was Nestorianism. Nestor was a bishop. He was a bishop of Antioch. And in the Eastern world, Antioch and Alexandria were rivals. They didn't like each other, mainly because whenever a position as the patriarch, what's what they called the bishop, the patriarch of Constantinople became available, that's usually the two places they looked. Who's the bishop of Antioch? Who's the bishop of Alexandria? And so those two were always at each other. And they both agreed that Jesus is both God and human, but in Antioch, they kind of leaned towards the human. And in Alexandria, they kind of leaned towards the divine. And so they loved, for political reasons, to pick apart each other's statements and try and catch one another in heretical traps. And then they'd have a big council and say, oh, Nestor said this, and now we need to decide if he's a heretic and how we're going to word this and whatnot. At the Council of Ephesus, Nestor, who, you know, was very much in favor of both Jesus being God and human, leaned towards human. They caught him saying something, I believe, that Mary was the mother of the Christ, not the mother of God. It's little things like that, play on words. Well, if you're not saying that Mary is the mother of God, then you must be denying the divinity of Jesus, and so we're going to come after you. Just little things like that. And Nestor was declared the council. Nestor had supporters from Antioch coming. The Pope Leo in Rome supported Nestor, but the advocates had not got to Ephesus yet. The Alexandrian contingent was given control of the council. And they started the council without Nestor's defendants getting there. They would not allow Pope Leo's letter to be read. And they kind of shoehorned through this decision that declared Nestor to be a heretic. He resigned. He went back to Antioch. He was embarrassed. People were not sure if they could be affiliated with him because the ecumenical council had declared him to be a heretic. Once he got to a place where he couldn't even stay around Antioch, he escaped to anybody know where? He went to Petra. If you've been to Petra, it's about as far out of the way as you can go. I mean, he's running and he's at the end of the road. He says, like, I'm going to go somewhere where nobody will find me. And he found the right place. But that's where he ended up retiring. And here's a guy that was a follower of Jesus, believed in the divinity and the humanity of Christ and served the church. But because of the political games that were being played in the eastern part of the empire, was cast out as a heretic and lived most of the rest of his life in hiding. This was the nature of a lot of these stories. The council at Chalcedon is important. Chalcedon would become a landmark differentiation between people moving forward, the same way Nicaea and Arianism had before. And from Chalcedon moving forward, you're going to have people that say Jesus is of only one nature. The records will refer to those as monophysitists, one nature. Chalcedon said Jesus is two natures. He's two natures in one person. He's divine, he's human. But a lot of the peoples that were responding to Rome in the east, a lot of those in the south, Ethiopia, Egypt, were monophysitists. The Christians in northern Africa ended up being monophysitists, which really led to the ease of which the Islamic tribes would overrun them when that time came. So the Council of Chalcedon is also one of the more important ones. The first few notes there, Council of Nicaea, which you've already covered. I gave those to you just for your records. The first Council of Constantinople, beginning, and these notes, by the way, I put them in the order that made sense to me, not the order that they made sense to my professor. So we're back up to page 60 now. But you see the Council of Ephesus in 431, that was the issue of Nestorianism on page 60. John of Antioch at the bottom of page 61 was the leader of the defenders. And then beginning page 63, you have the other councils kind of run down. Council of Chalcedon on 63, Second Council of Constantinople 553, the Third Council of Constantinople 680-681. The issue there was not the nature of Jesus, but the wills. Monophysitism would be one nature. Monothelitism would be one will. Did Jesus have one will or two wills? All of these involving the person and idea of Jesus, nature of Jesus. The one exception was the last one, and that's the one we talked about. Page 67, the Second Council of Nicaea, which revolved around the issue of icons and images in worship. And that one is, you know, if you didn't grow up in a church where icons are important, you ought to read through those because it does kind of elucidate what iconic components in Catholicism and the Orthodox Church mean. There is the language about we don't worship them, we revere them as it pertains to saints. There is a very important component of illiterate people and the way we don't have Bibles. So the way we tell the stories is we create stained glass that tells the stories, or we create images or icons that tell the stories, because so when people walk by the church, they see Moses and they see David and they see the Nativity. And when we don't have Bibles, they serve a very, you know, functional role. The challenge within that council was, how do we have them and use them appropriately? How do we make sure they don't become sources of idolatry, which was what the Old Testament laws were always about anyways? And that, I would suggest, probably remains the issue within those churches today. How do we use them in an appropriate way, or saints and icons and relics and things like that, have they come to hold a superstitious, idolatrous place or role in the hearts of individuals? I don't know that it's universally one or the other, but I do think that what they were trying to avoid, the danger of idolatry in these things, has definitely been a part of the tradition of both of those churches. It has caused lots of people to trip up. That being said, those things also serve the purpose of education in lots of instances, and so I don't know that you can throw the baby out with the bathwater, but that Second Council of Nicaea was predominantly revolving around the issue of icons and images. 800, Charlemagne becomes king of the West. That's where we'll pick up next week. We went Eastern Christianity through a lot of these councils. In 1000 is when there's the first schism between the East and West, religiously speaking. And at around 1050, 58 is whenever West goes fully Roman Catholic and East goes fully Eastern Orthodox. And that orthodoxy will spread and it grows. There's Coptic Orthodoxy in Egypt. There's Greek Orthodoxy in Greece. Their missionary movement will spread into Bulgaria and become Bulgarian Orthodoxy. Whenever Vladimir, the ruler of Russia, what would become Russia, looks for ideas about Christianity and wants to find out about Christianity, he does not send to Rome. He sends to Constantinople. And so Russia, throughout its history, is not Catholic. Russia is Orthodox, Russian Orthodoxy. But the Orthodox Church would have a very significant influence over the eastern part of the world moving forward after the schism of 1058. So we will dive into King Charlemagne, the reconvergence of the West, next week.